Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence, and by Chevrolet, the all-new Chevrolet Cruze. Get used to more.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 96 for Thursday, March 24th, 2011. Lingenfelterized. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLineDetroit.tv every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine After Hours in the iTunes Store. Thanks, everybody, for joining us again Thursday night here as we go live with Auto Line After Hours. And joining me, as always, my co-partner in crime, the auto extremist, Peter DeLorenzo.
And how are you?
Mr. DeLorenzo.
Just removing my bulletproof vest in case any UAW members are out there trying to get me.
We'll be talking about some of that getting going soon here. But also joining us, Jim McCraw, great friend of mine, longtime journalist.
John.
It's great having you here.
Lovely to be here.
And
thank
I'm not
you.
Sure who do I identify you being with these days.
Just too many. Just
too many.
Don't
yeah,
bother.
Many.
Freelance automotive journalist.
And also joining us tonight, Ken Lingenfelter. Ken, great having you here with us on Auto Line After Hours.
Great to be here, John.
We'll have to talk about your business and everything that you're doing, but first thing that we have to do is talk about Scotty Burgess, because last week's show was all about Scott.
And he's back.
And he's back at the Detroit News.
Detroit News apologized, and he went back, and all is...
And all is right with the world again, I think.
Yeah.
Well, I thought it was big of the Detroit News to go out and apologize as openly as they did. And I'm sure glad that Scott went back there.
Yeah, I think the news did the right thing, and I'm glad Scott returned. So
this will be interesting to watch. Is he going to get even bolder now than he was before?
That's a good question.
Or maintain an even strain? And
I think he'll do what he's been doing. I don't think he'll give it much thought.
That's right.
Just,
well, now they know that if they are uncomfortable with his copy, you got to jump on it before it goes out for publication. And that's okay. And another thing that I saw this week is that National Speed Sport News has ceased publishing a print I don't know what to call it. Newspaper, magazine? It's really more like
weekly
a newspaper,
paper.
Right?
Yeah, for those of us.
It was always on newsprint and just black and white for decades and decades.
For those of us of a certain age, that was how you really read about, in depth, about racing. Because in the Stone Age, racing wasn't on television. I mean,
or if it was, everything was way delayed.
Yeah.
Which is funny because the same guy was there on TV, Chris Economaki and ABC Wide World of Sports.
Yeah.
He was at the Daytona 500 and all the other majors that they did at the time. And it was his paper his whole life. I mean, that was his life.
Well, what's amazing is, you know, as you mentioned, Peter, here it is before internet, not very much motor racing on television. And Chris Economaki was a nationally known figure. Everybody knew who Chris Economaki was.
Yeah, I mean, and the newsprint, the physical paper was what you got if you wanted to follow racing, from local short tracks all the way to the big events. And so they ceased publication of the newsprint version. And, I mean, it's a sign of the times. I mean, people want everything immediately all the time, and print just it's going away.
It is going away. But what I find extraordinary is he started this in, what was it, 1936?
Well, actually,
I know we reported it today and I can't remember what the date
actually,
was.
Actually, someone else started it, right? And he was writing for it and then he took it over.
So, but he was certainly the guy who made it what it was, and he had stringers. I mean, nobody even talks about stringers anymore and knows who they are or what they do, but that was the guy who stayed until the last race was run, typed his report, and mailed it to New Jersey. It sounds so strange now, but that's the way it works.
So archaic, exactly right. But
and you would, if you were lucky and you were at Elephant's Breath Speedway in Montana, you got this much back page.
And if you had a subscription, you had to have it airmailed so you got it sooner. Otherwise, you got it a week late.
Just put it directly on the bottom of the parrot's cage and don't even bother because it's old news.
But it's too bad. However, they still have an online presence, but that's a question mark, too.
Chris was an amazing guy. I met him on a number of occasions. What a hoot. I mean, he's just a
wonderful storyteller.
One of the best storytellers of all time, right?
He's 90 now.
Is he really? Well, I'm glad to hear that he's still alive and kicking then.
Yeah, I don't know how his health is, but...
Well, again, to me, it's still extraordinary that a motorsports reporter, really, got to become known nationally. And I don't think anybody before or since has ever achieved that status as a motorsports reporter.
And he always asked when the driver got, what was it like out there or something? Yeah, that's what he always asked.
What was it like out there
when Richard Petty was on your bumper, David Pearson? Mm-hmm.
He was not above playing the occasional really good trick either. I was on a press event with Jaguar in England, right? We were at Silverstone, and it was time to go to dinner, and all these Jaguar limousines and chauffeurs were out in front of the hotel. And we started off, and pretty soon Chris says, wait a minute. He recognized the terrain. He said, driver, stop. So everybody pulled over, didn't know why, because nobody had cell phones or anything. And he said, I know a great restaurant. And we went to this restaurant that he knew, and we walked in, and the owner goes, Chris, it was hilarious. The guys had been racing buddies for years and years and years for the Formula One race in Silverstone. And he'd been going there for years and years, and pretty soon we all sat down, and the owner comes over, and we're having great service and great conversation, and John Judd, the engine builder, walks in. Hey, John, come on over here. It was hilarious, and the Jaguar people loved every minute of it.
Yeah,
they loved having their dinner hijacked because it was Chris.
Yeah, he could get away with a lot because he was Chris. Some of the other stuff... that I've been working on this week, and I know, Peter, your column this week was all about the UAW, and, man, they came down like a ton of bricks on Alan Mulally. Bob King, the president of the UAW, came out and called...
The chief disturber.
Yeah, said that Mulally's pay was immoral.
Yeah.
I've never heard anybody in the union accuse anyone in management of having immoral pay levels.
People don't understand unless they've lived in this area, but when you've seen, the history of the unions, there was at one point in history when unions were very important. We passed that about 40 years ago, and ever since, this state, this region, this business has been decimated by the union mentality, the entitlement mentality. And, when Gettelfinger was retiring, I wrote my column that the car companies are going to wish for Gettelfinger back because Bob King is a frickin' nightmare, and he's just getting warmed up. He was pushing now the social agenda. He marched everyone out of Cobalt Hall at the end of the conference this week to picket the Bank of America because they made too much money, and they didn't share it with everybody. I'm sorry, but sharing the wealth thing, people don't understand how, all I hear is, oh, these guys don't work. Al Mulally doesn't work. None of these guys work. They have no idea what it's like to be an executive in this business, in this town, especially the last 5 years. It has been an up-at-dawn, pride-swallowing siege. Thanks, Cameron Crowe, for that line from Jerry Maguire. And it's 24/7, and people don't understand it. Jim, you've seen it?
I have.
I mean, these guys and gals, they work, I'm not saying that what the UAW members do good work. They're involved. They come in, they do their job, and they leave. These guys, the job never leaves. It is 24 hours a day, literally.
Every day.
And this is not something that Alan Mulally thought up on his own. He didn't go to the bank of Ford Motor Company and say, I'd like $113 million because I've been working really hard. This was voted, I believe, by the board of directors.
Yeah, and don't forget the swing, financial swing of Ford, you know, before Alan got there to now, is in the hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars. And, you know, when you factor in his cut of it, it's, you know, it's not all that much. Yeah, it's a lot of money, but I'll tell you what, he and his team deserve every penny of it, because without their efforts and their constant focus, there wouldn't be a Ford Motor Company, and there wouldn't be any Ford jobs. So,
well, I think not to mention that they never took a dime from Uncle Gov. Did it all on their own.
And they still have a long way to go.
Well, and they still have the mortgage payments to Goldman Sachs.
Yeah, and make no mistake. Yeah, and make no mistake, Bob King and his minions are saying, oh, we want our cut. Detroit isn't out of the woods yet.
No.
Not by a long shot. I mean, we've just seen what's happened in Japan with this horrible tragedy of the tsunami and the nuclear stuff and the shutdowns of the plants and the supplier disruption. And, you know, just when Detroit is eking out some momentum, I mean, it could all go away.
It could all go away.
So to sit up there and say, we want our cut, we gave it all up and we want it all back, I mean, it's just...
You know, the fact of the matter is they really didn't take all that much in cuts. They really didn't take any pay cuts. They still have their pensions. They still have their health care. Yes, a lot of hourly people lost their jobs, but the ones who stayed, all they gave up was future raises. They never really took cuts. They call that a cut. Oh, I didn't get my raise. I took a cut. Whereas everybody else is taking big-time cuts. They're not foregoing raises. You know, another thing, too, that I see that goes on, if you talk to folks, because it's not just those in the union who say, oh, how can Alan possibly get a $56 million bonus? Because, you know, if you talk about sports figures, there's a lot of sports figures who make that kind of money, a lot of them. And the general public and the hourly guys will say, yeah, but, you know, they know I can't throw the ball that fast. I can't throw the ball that far. I can't run that fast or whatever it is. So they recognize those sports figures can do something that I can't. But they all, and everyone I've ever talked to says, I could run General Motors. I could run Ford Motor Company. So why should they get that kind of money? Because
I know. About 15 minutes.
Right. They get through halfway through the first meeting and know they're so far in over their head. But I find this amongst people is they all believe they can run these big corporations. So there's no way in hell that these CEOs should make the kind of money that they make.
Yeah. And that's too bad. And you bring up a good analogy with the sports figures. I mean, come on. I mean, we're talking about the elite.
Michael Schumacher drove a race car and earned between $60 and $80 million
a year.
Every year he was in it.
Yeah.
And he continues to have endorsements for the rest of his life.
And unfortunately, the average person on the street doesn't equate that kind of level of talent with who we're dealing with in these businesses.
A-Rod's contract was $230-plus million to play baseball.
But we're talking about elite, talented, visionary business people.
And I think this is the critical part. It's the issue that you raised, Peter. He did it. They're not just dumping a bunch of money on him, which has happened with executives. They got a whole bunch of money and drove the company into the ground, and they still got a lot of money.
Yeah.
Alan Mulally made and is making piles of money because, to your point, he's, you know, doubled or tripled the value of the company.
Yeah, he succeeded. It's just like when Babe Ruth was paid $100,000 a year in 1927. And the press said, well, don't you feel that that's an outrageous amount of money? You make more than President of the United States. I had a better year than the president. Still one of the greatest quotes ever.
I had a better year than he did.
And you know what? Alan Mulally's had a better year than 25 A-Rods put together. Not just 1 year, 4 years.
And he didn't luck out. That's the other thing. He went in and has transformed that company. Oh, yeah. And I think he's even transforming the culture. You know, we're all hoping that he hangs on a few more years, because if he does, he will have achieved a total culture change there.
So I don't really know
what the employee count is now at Ford Motor Company. It used to be 360,000 people, but even if it's now 150,000 worldwide, they all depend on him. A-Rod has 24 other guys on his little team.
Right.
I mean, a lot of, you know, it's been a horrible trend. It's been a horrible 4 years for the U.S. automobile industry. A lot of people lost their jobs, not just hourly people. Countless, thousands of salaried people lost their jobs.
And they lost everything.
And they lost everything. And this state has been decimated. So I really take umbrage with the UAW resurrecting this hoary rhetoric, this old thing, we got to get ours and all this stuff, where this state, and we're just barely off the mat, and it could easily go south. It's not the time to start ratcheting up that rhetoric. It isn't. And Bob King, you know, all the UAW people, they see this fire in front of them and this fire to the side, and that's
it. In light of the mess that the Japanese supply chain is in, his timing was really bad.
Yeah.
I mean, when you talk to almost anybody about, well, who makes your ignition system? Nippon Denso. Oh, yeah, where is that made? Oh, it's in Japan. Well, if that little plant is shut down, this Dodge or that Chevrolet has no ignition system,
yeah,
so we can't finish it.
Remember that old just-in-time thing?
Therefore, we cannot sell it.
Right. Yeah. Remember that old just-in-time philosophy? Man.
Well, let's get into that in a minute, but let's take a quick break for one of our sponsors right now. And we're pleased to say that Chevrolet is a sponsor of the show. Check it out at Chevrolet.com/cruise. They've got all kinds of things on that car that you may want to check out. We've been talking about this all along. Bluetooth connectivity, two accessory power outlets, one in the front, one in the back for rear passengers. OnStar turn-by-turn. A whole bunch of other stuff, rear park assist, rollover mitigation. And like I said, it's just too much to go on right here about, but you can check it out at Chevrolet.com/cruise. And of course, that's C-R-U-Z-E. So yeah, this is amazing, this disruption that's gone on in Japan. You know, I said from the very beginning, look, if they're closed down a week or two, okay, the system can absorb that. But if it goes beyond that, watch out. And now it's like every day we're reporting that production is being delayed again. Just for a few days here and a few days there, but, you know, that's
it
all it
adds
takes.
Up.
That
sure.
Sends ripples out, you know.
Well, you know, sure, because GM closes Shreveport, Louisiana, where they make the Colorado and the Canyon. Next thing you know, Tonawanda engine plant's closing down because it ships to the plant. And I don't know what else is going on, but to your point, Peter, the ripple effect. You know, a stamping plant's going to go down, then a transmission plant's going to go down, then the seat supplier and the whole supplier community is going to be affected by it. And that's just one plant.
Yeah, and you know, this business is on a fragile footing anyway. You know, yeah, there's signs of life and there's profits and all that, but you're talking about an industry that lost hundreds of billions of dollars for years. And this disaster in Japan is going to have a negative effect.
Well, Toyota's announced that its plants in North America are going to be affected. And, you know, if it's Toyota, then Honda and Nissan are likely to be affected as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's reports coming out of Europe now that they see disruptions hitting there. So, yeah, for the union to come out and say, okay, we want it all back, is pretty short-sighted.
Spectacularly bad timing. He should have just shut up. But he didn't.
That's right.
Oh, well.
Well, we'll have to see how that all evolves. But let's talk about more fun stuff. Let's talk about our other guest who's here, Ken Lingenfelter. Ken, it's great to have you here.
Horsepower.
Yeah.
Boy, and we like to make horsepower, let me tell you. So.
Well, first off, we got to start out by explaining to the audience who you are, because we messed up in one of our promos for today's show, saying that you're the one who started Lincoln Falter, and you're not.
Right.
So let's get the story of what the company's all about.
Sure. You know, the thing is, the company itself was started 35 years ago by John Lingenfelter. John was a distant cousin of mine, and very distant, but John was a Penn State grad, extremely focused on the engineering side of the business, incredible car enthusiast, absolutely over-the-top drag racer. Actually, years ago he said, I'm probably going to kill myself drag racing. Unfortunately, that's what happened. John was severely injured in some testing of a Chevy Cavalier, believe it or not, had about 1,400 horsepower, and was out.
Even imagine a Cavalier with 1,400 horsepower.
Unbelievable! But he'd do the drag strip in about 6.2 in that thing. Was out at Pomona, had a horrendous accident. The accident itself didn't kill him, but injuries from the accident. Cost him his life later that year. Actually died Christmas Day of 2003. Hmm. He had 13 NHRA Grand National titles. Everybody knew the Lingenfelter name. Built an incredible brand that I'm really proud I've got an opportunity to take forward now.
So how did you come into the picture?
Well, you know, I've been an enthusiast. I mean, my parents talk about the fact when I was three or four, I'd stand on the hump of the 55 Chevy and name every car that went by. And I think I probably had every Matchbox toy that they made back then. I just have been a car enthusiast forever. I actually had a career in the real estate development and title insurance and real estate business. And had started my companies back when I was 23, built those companies, took them across probably the eastern side of the country, had something short of 3,000 employees, and had an incredible, great career. I built a business during a business window that from 1978 to 2003, when I sold the business to a First American Corporation, a very large public company. And all during that time, I collected cars, and I had John build a couple of cars for me, and I stayed very in tune with racing and did some racing and just had a blast. After John had passed away, his daughters got the company. They, in turn, sold it to some partners that were people that were locally running the building or the business. And I think they were car guys, but they really weren't business people. Sometime about 4 years ago, John's brother, Charlie, who's still very involved in the drag racing field, approached me and asked me if I'd come in and take the family business and try to make sure John's legacy lived on. And so not only had I sold my other business and was ready to take on a new challenge, it was in something that was actually my dream. And so
you're having a blast doing this?
I'm having a blast. Fun factor's huge. We're really having a good time. So,
how's business?
Business is good. We've got plenty of work. It's very tough for any small business to make a profit these days.
Tell me about it.
Yeah. I mean, we were at a SEMA show a couple years ago. I think 80% of the companies there were probably for sale.
Wow.
But we've seen a bit of a resurgence with the auto companies getting better. Our business has gotten better. Camaro was a tuner's dream.
The new Camaro.
It's been a real lifeblood for just about every tuner out there, and we're having a blast with that car.
So tell us, what does your company do these days?
Well, you know, we tune customer cars. Customers bring us their cars to get more horsepower, and we're real good at that. We build engines, also somewhat good at that. We do some racing and drag racing mostly. We do a little bit. We've got a few clients and customers that do road racing, and that's a fun part of our business also. So it's mostly building customers' cars, and mostly customers that are involved in drag racing. We've got a very big parts business. We've got a lot of parts we've developed and engineered ourselves, and we probably 50% of our business is selling parts to other jobbers and to our customers. And
What kind of cars do you specialize in?
Almost all General Motors products. We worked with
Corvette, Camaro. Corvette, what else?
Corvette, Camaro, mostly. We did do a little bit of work with Magnuson and the Dodge Challenger this year, and had some real good success with that. But
aren't you also the only company out there that took a look at the Camaro and said, you know what, this would make a really nice Firebird?
Well,
so you redid the entire nose to look like a sort of a 70 Firebird?
Let me tell you the story about that. You know, obviously, we'd been building Camaros and Corvettes and Firebirds for customers forever. And, you know, General Motors decided they needed to drop Pontiac. And I'm sure there's a lot of smart guys up there that thought that that was the right thing to do. But it really kind of frustrated me because, you know.
Oh, let me interrupt you there because sure. We had Bob Lutz here, and Bob Lutz said he didn't want to drop Pontiac. It was Ratner and the feds who told him to get rid of it. He thought that they were starting to turn it around.
Well, it's a shame because it really was the excitement brand. They had some great products. The GTO, you know, went through a couple of reiterations. But the Firebird was a personal favorite of mine. And when they dropped it, we realized it was going to be one less product we'd get a chance to build. So I talked to our guys. I said, you know, there's no reason why we can't build one ourselves. So we looked at all the different years and all the different designs, and we all thought that the Super Duty look was the one we wanted, the 1970 to 74 look. We put our heads together, decided what the car had to have and didn't have, you know, with the gills on the side and the shaker hood and the vinyl blue interior, and we built a concept car that we wanted to take out to SEMA. And the goal was to just show it off and have some fun. We took it out, we put it in the Nitto tire booth, and it was a smashing success. We got more attention from more people.
Here, we got it up on the screen right now.
We put a 455 cubic inch engine in it. It was our motor we built, 655 horsepower. It's got honeycomb wheels. You can't see them in that picture.
And it looks authentic. I mean, it looks true. That's what amazed me when I saw the car was it looks pretty good.
Yeah, you know, John, our goal was to make the car look like we thought General Motors should have built it. So it really does look like an OEM car. I think that's one of the things that was attractive about it at SEMA. And it was so much fun. I stood there practically the whole show and just answered questions and had people come by, and everybody had a Firebird story. Either their dad had one or their uncle had one or their brother had one or whatever. And it was just one after the other, and everybody kept saying, you got to build this car. You got to build it. From there, we went to Barrett Jackson and had somewhat of the same kind of reaction. Now, just to clarify, this car, the concept car, is white. It's got kind of a pearl finish with a lucent blue stripe. And we found the original supplier that supplied General Motors with the blue vinyl interior and the loop carpeting that you put in that also. So we put that in the concept car. And that was as successful as the appearance on the outside. So, you know, the whole thing just seemed to be something we should really look into. So we started checking it out, looking at what it would take to produce the car. Refining our molds, and we've been working through all of the things that you need to get through in order to get that car up to limited production. We've got a stack of names. I haven't taken any deposits from anybody because I wanted to make sure absolutely that we'd build the car.
Now, wait a minute. One of my pals in the business here, Bill Kazira from TI Automotive, says he wants one of those cars.
We've got a list of people. Actually, it was funny because at Barrett Jackson the first year, we had a guy show up from the Baltimore Ravens, and he just went crazy over the car, and he went back, and I think he brought the whole team back the next day. So we've got some orders to fill once we get the car up into production, and we're very close now.
And let me ask you a question about your – go ahead, Peter.
No, I was just going to say, do you know how much more it's going to be to do it over – if you buy – you bring you a Camaro, is that one?
Yeah, Peter, we're going to build the car, I think, in three levels. That real big engine, the motor in that concept car was like $40,000, $35,000 alone. So
the first level is basically taking a Camaro and doing all the body work,
right,
and leaving the drivetrain.
I think in the end we'll probably sell more just modified LS3 engines rather than convert the whole motor. When you got to tear the whole car apart and repaint it, that gets expensive. So if someone brings us a white car and, you know, we can paint the lucent blue stripe on it, make some changes in the interior, we can build it for a lot less money. I'm thinking that, and by the way, we decided also that we needed to do a V6 version because 75% of Camaro production is V6. We couldn't fit a shaker hood underneath that V6 engine, so we opted to go with one of my personal favorites of the cars was the Formula car. So we've got a version that we built right now that's got the two scoops that come out to the front of the car.
That's the honeycomb wheel.
There's the honeycomb wheels there.
Yeah, but that's got the shaker hood.
But and it's it doesn't have the air dam in the front, so it's a little cleaner look. We just finished that car last week. Regular, you know, regulation headlights, taillights. It's the closest version in, that we have ready for production. So that car will probably be in the low 20s plus the donor car. The modified LS car, LS3 car, will be probably low 30s and the plus the donor car. And then we will build some of the 655 horsepower, what we call the big dog car, for some of our real extreme customers. And I think that's probably going to be something just under 100,000, maybe a little over. Mm-hmm. So we bought all the rest of the material from the guy that had that vinyl blue interior in the carpeting, so we can build a few more cars just like the concept car. So,
what were you asking, Jim?
Basically, what's the business model? And that's the answer. You have to get a donor car to get around all the crazy federal regulations. You put miles on it, and you present it to them, and they turn it into the Pontiac of your dreams.
You know, they talk about, you know, these cars being a labor of love. It, obviously, with a concept car, you know, we've got a lot of funds to recover, a lot of development costs to recover. I'm not as concerned about that as I am just having a blast with the project. We might build 25 cars. We might build 300 cars. I'm not sure. We'll be ready to fill orders, and we'll build them as long as we can. So
excellent.
So the business is picking up then?
It is picking up. Obviously, I'm not going to build a production facility with, you know, assembly lines and things like that. It's just not a smart thing to do in this kind of economy. But we'll have a limited production area. I'm hoping to build a couple of cars a week, and we'll see how it goes. So it has been a blast, though. So much fun. We actually sent one of the cars, our red car, on the Hot Rod Power Tour last year. And it was amazing, the stories. People were coming up to us and telling us how General Motors is going to build this car and everything else, and we're just kind of, no, that's not, you don't really have that quite right. You know, this is our car. So, but lots of fun.
Mm-hmm. Will you be churning out a Lingenfelterized ZL1? I mean, they're only going to build, what, 69 cars?
Is that right?
That's what they said at Chicago.
Yeah.
I can't imagine that they would stop at 69
cars. I can't either. But if they stop at 69, boy, they're going to make a ton of money on that.
Yeah. You know, we have what we call our L28, and we've been building that for a while. And we just finished the prototype for what we call our Signature Series cars. That's a body kit with our L28 body kit with the big motor and everything else. And so I guess the simple answer to your question is there'll be maybe some kind of LT1, but it'll bear the Lingenfelter name. So we don't want to get in any trouble with anybody.
No.
What's the market for those cars in terms of resale and all those sorts of things? I mean, this is something that you buy because you love it, right?
And it's, yeah, I think it is. I mean, anybody who thinks that, you know, they're going to make money on cars of any kind, I mean, this has been kind of an up-and-down market. As you know, John, I've got a large car collection also. And that's also a labor of love. If anybody thinks they're going to go into the car collecting business and make money, that's...
Well, wait a minute. Who is that? Nick Mason from Pink Floyd, right? Isn't he starting like a mutual fund investing in classic cars?
Well, good luck to him. You know, I'm not going to be buying any of those, buying into that mutual fund. You know, the ups and downs, there have been a few guys that have hit some home runs, obviously. You know, there were some guys that had some Hemi-Cudas at the time when they were really hot. And I'm sure glad I didn't get stuck with one of those that somebody needed $2 million or $1.5 million for. But you better love it. And, you know, if you make a few bucks on one car, then that's great.
Because you're going to lose some.
You're going to lose some on another. It's got to balance itself out. So,
hey, let's take another quick break here, and then we'll get back into the discussion. But we want to thank our sponsor, Bridgestone. And you can check out all their information at BridgestoneTire.com.
Cool.
With their Run Flat Tires, offers peace of mind for consumers. And you can check it out because they've got the third generation. No more of those added mass and stiffer sidewalls that can compromise ride comfort and fuel efficiency. They've got something pretty good there. And you can get that information again at BridgestoneTire.com. And yeah, we just saw the orange one that came up on the screen there briefly that you guys were talking about as I was reading that ad. But to me, that's the classic color of that car.
Well, it, you know, they had the Buccaneer Red, and that was our goal there. It's a big screaming chicken on the hood. We had to build one of those. That car actually has our version of the rally wheel that they put on Firebird back then.
And, which was kind of a reminiscent of the American mags back then.
Right.
Yeah. Have you heard from anybody at General Motors for having done this car?
You know, privately we have, but and I think they all wish they could have built it, and I don't blame them. I'm pretty careful of that. I like all those people over there. They're all friends of ours. You know, we don't want to step on anybody's toes. And I frankly think a lot of them are glad we did it because somebody needed to. To not do something with Firebird just would have been a real shame. So, and mind you, there are a couple other people who have tried to do it, too. There are a couple other companies out there that have their own idea about what they think Firebird should have looked like. I like ours the best, naturally, but I think they've done a good job on their cars, too.
Well, yeah, but what impressed me about your car was, or is, the fit and the finish and the gaps in the panels. So many of the modified cars have got gigantic gaps. I mean, you almost can stick your pinky down in the gap there, and when I was going over your car, I was really impressed by the build quality and the manufacturing of the parts on it.
Well, keep in mind, you know, we're calling it a Lingenfelder TA, and so that car's got my name on it. And I'm going to be absolutely certain that the fit and finish is just as good as it can be. That's frankly why we haven't pushed it out for production yet, because I wanted to make sure we're just making absolutely certain everything is completely right. And when those cars are out, I'm going to be very comfortable that my name is on them. And I think our customers will be very happy with them. So,
cool. You mentioned you got a car collection. Tell us a little bit about that. And I think, Jim, didn't you bring some pictures along of that?
Yes, Ken and I got together for a short. He was having a very busy day, so his curator let me in, and I shot just about every car in the place. It's many and varied. There's not a particular theme, but I think you have probably collected more interesting Callaway Corvettes than anybody short of Reeves Callaway.
There you go.
And he has a wonderful muscle collection.
Yeah.
All kinds.
Seen it, Peter.
Yeah, it's very cool.
You know, again, fun factor with that has been really high. Jim's right. There's no real theme. It's cars I liked. But if you looked at it, it's about 30% muscle cars, and it's about 30% exotic cars, and about 40% Corvettes Lingenfelder products.
The Daytona, is that one?
No, that's
the prototype V8.
Right.
Duntoff Mule. Yep.
Right.
Duntoff Mule. Yeah, where'd you get your hands on that?
Yeah. Well,
you know, that's a good question, because I think I was just at the right place at the right time. I bought that car at auction. The reserve on it was way up in the ceiling. I thought, well, I'd love that car, but I'll never be able to buy it. I always try to keep a limit on myself, and it came across the auction block at a price I thought was pretty good, so I picked it up, and it's been all over the place. Articles been written on it. There's books about it. There's coffee table books that the car is in. So,
when it's one of one,
you got something special
rare.
There.
As
that's
rare
right.
As it gets.
You know, Smokey Yannick built the motor in that car.
Did he really?
That car survived a tornado. We've got pictures of that. It's got
real historical value,
it
not
really
just
does.
The appeal of being a car like it is.
Right, and boy, it even sounds great for a car that old and everything else. It's got a wonderful sound to it. So,
well, that's cool. Peter gave me Smokey Yannick's book, his autobiography. What an amazing story! What an amazing guy. So, to have a car, especially a Duntoff car with a Yannick engine in it, that. Like you say, Jim, one of a kind.
One.
It's pretty cool. We've got the only supercharged 53 Corvette also. Very, very unique car. Wasn't supercharged by General Motors, but it was done by McCullough. They were trying to convince...
McCullough? As in the chainsaw guys?
Yeah. They had decided that they wanted to convince General Motors to use the supercharger rather than a V8. Now, obviously, the V8 won out.
So you get that nice, smooth inline six.
Yeah, blue flame, yeah. Actually, I think it probably increased the horsepower about 10, but but it's pretty cool. You know, you've got that supercharger sitting on there, a couple little extra gauges on the dashboard, and so it gets a lot of attention. Actually, Bill Warner asked me to bring it down to Amelia Island next year for the
Oh, excellent.
Corvette show down there, so it'd be nice to show
well,
up.
Well, you should call him back and say, I'm only going to bring the supercharged if I can bring the Dunta Mule.
Oh, he wants that car, too. It's going also. So, yeah.
I don't.
So you don't have brass cars or things like that? You're into cars that go fast.
I'm into cars that go fast. When I was a teenager, it was the late 60s, early 70s. All the muscle cars were really out there. You know, Telegraph Road and Woodward Avenue were places where everybody got together. And, you know, there was a race or two going on back then. Those were my favorites. I tried real hard to acquire the cars that were cars I couldn't afford back then, would have liked to have had. But there's about 160 cars in the collection right now. And like I said, 30% of them are muscle cars.
Wow. So, 160 cars. That's a nice collection.
It's fun. I can't open it to the public, but we do. This has been a real positive thing. We've been doing a bunch of charity events in there.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing how many events we have done. We've got a big event coming up for the Boy Scouts on the 28th of April. We've done some hospital events where they bring, you know, their hopefully charitable folks in. They have some wine and cheese, and everybody walks around and looks at the car and cars and hopefully opens up their wallets and contributes heavily to the charity. So that's been fun. We've given away silent tours in live and silent auctions of the collection, where we take people around individually in small groups, and that's been a good fundraiser. Car clubs, we do invite car clubs in, obviously around Dream Cruise and around the concourse, and Eyes on Design. We get a lot of people that come in from out of town that want to see the collection. So,
and, you know, looking at the pictures that are going on the screen here as we're talking, all different makes. I mean, it's not like, you know, you said your business is mainly General Motors and some Dodge stuff.
Sure.
Now, but your collection is all over the map.
Well, on the exotic side, you know, there's about 15 Ferraris in there. There's several Lamborghinis. I do have a Bugatti Veyron in there. That's pretty cool. There were only 20 Lamborghini Reventons made. There's a Reventon in the collection, an Enzo Ferrari, 288 GTO. Just a lot of really fun cars. And, again, cars I liked. Jim mentioned Reeves Calloway a little while ago. Reeves and I have been very good friends. And, you know, we kind of were competitors also, Reeves and Tuner also. But Reeves and I built a couple of cars together. One of them was the latest Speedster off of his C16 car. And we took the cover off of that at Pebble Beach about 3 years ago and just had a blast with that project, too. So
that's excellent.
What's the rarest muscle car that you have? And you have a Hemi Cuda convertible, I think, four-speed?
Well, I did. That's not there anymore. Well, what's happened is I'm always freshening up the collection, too, because I've got this bad habit of wanting to go to auctions. And, you know, my friends tease me. They tell stories about a lot of people wanting to bring duct tape and rope to tie me to the chair so I stay in my seat.
Keep that hand down.
Keep the hand down, yeah. But there is a Challenger in there that they only made about 12 of. There's a Dodge Coronet convertible with a four-speed and a Hemi that's a one-off car. I've got several cars out of Otis Chandler's collection. Otis Chandler was the editor of the L.A. Times, and he had a big car collection and passed away some years ago. And so there's a Yanko Chevrolet Chevelle and a Yanko a Chevelle Copo.
The first real serious collector of muscle cars, wasn't he? He predated a lot of that, didn't he?
Yanko?
No, Chandler.
Oh, Chandler.
Yeah, he did have a very serious collection. And he started
with motorcycles.
Yeah.
And when he got as many of those as, I mean, you can fit a lot more motorcycles in any given building than cars, but I guess he just said enough, and then he started collecting muscle cars very seriously. But
yeah,
he had some beautiful classics, too.
I felt awful fortunate, too. I was at Barrett-Jackson when they started to auction off some of the GM Heritage collection. And so I've got some cars that, you know, came out of that collection.
They let some pretty good cars go there.
I'm pretty pleased with the ones I got. I'm very excited about
it. When I saw the list of what they were selling off, this preceding the whole bankruptcy and everything, I was kind of astonished at some of the vehicles they let go. They told me, however, those were mostly duplicates. I don't know if that was the case.
I think so. I think to a certain degree. I mean, if you get out to the Heritage Collection these days, there's still some really good cars out there. They had several warehouses full of cars, but I think it was probably hard on a lot of people to see any of them go. And and I think there are a number of people that were glad that I bought them because they know they went back into a collection.
I don't know that they ever actually copped to a number, but I heard a number as high as 700 cars.
That they have in total at the GM Heritage?
At their peak, they had 700 cars.
Wow.
And somebody that we know told me a story about one of the buildings in the far-flung suburbs had to be redone for some new purpose, and they smacked down this cinder block wall, and there was a whole bunch of cars in a room that was not in the plans. There was a room there full of cars.
Wow.
Brand new cars.
Well, two things that they've got there now, or one that I saw was a Duck, which is a World War II era amphibious vehicle. It looks awesome. Awesome. And they told me they're trying to get a Stuart tank in there, too, which apparently had two Cadillac V8s in it. I don't know enough about the Stuart tank to say, but they're trying to get one of those in there. They've got their eye on one. They've got some really cool stuff in that collection, too.
It's very cool. And I think what everybody, what most people say about my car collection is it's just there's a lot of memories of the muscle cars. And I think, you know, Jay Leno said it, too, and said to me, I buy cars I like, and that's really what I've been doing. So mm-hmm. That's been fun.
Well, hey, why don't we get to rapid fire, and let's get to some of the questions coming in from the audience. Ben, let's bring up the graphic and let it roll. Okay, Bill Warner, founder and co-chairman of the Amelia Island Concours d'Elegance.
What does he want?
Well, he heard our question about, you know, are collector cars a good investment? And he says collector cars are a good investment if you live long enough. He says, P.S., really wanted to hear tonight's show, but I'm committed to a dinner. Maybe just committed. He says, John, we missed you at Amelia. Yeah, I know. I got to get down there. I'll try to do that. Next year. Davin says, it's my understanding that this is the aftermarket SLP ZL1s that will be limited to 69 units, not the regular production ZL1 from General Motors, which will probably be a few thousand units a year like the GT500.
That sure sounds a lot more logical to me.
Yeah.
Because I saw them at the
they're gonna make
Chicago
much
Auto Show and the Toronto Auto Show, and that their goal, I think, is to come out like Mustang did with, you know, advanced cars. And there'll be another Z28, I'm sure. And
oh, Z28's coming. I guarantee you that.
Yeah.
I've seen it. It's coming.
It's such a nice number, 550 horsepower. It just rolls off your tongue, doesn't
sure
it?
Sure do. Should be a law. Everyone has to have that. Jim Campbell wants to know, Ken, what are your thoughts on the performance business? With the relentless pursuit on speed by law enforcement, there are some states and provinces that are confiscating cars for speeding.
Well, you know, I'm sure that's the case. The fact of the matter is there are so many more venues these days to take your car out, drag strip, drag strips. One of the coolest things, I think, are some of these country clubs that are coming together that are just...
very cool.
Racing clubs.
Yeah, exactly. Autobahn Country Club out by Chicago. Mm-hmm. We've got a couple of tracks in here in Michigan. They're not quite like that. But
Gingerman's
a good one. Waterford opens up once in a while. So there are places to go out and enjoy.
Get your yayas out on the track.
Exactly. Right. But, you know, we don't encourage our customers to street race. We know they probably do. And
but, you know, it's like Mario Andretti always said, you pick your chances. You know, when you got a wide open road and there's not neighborhood kids or anything, that's when you let it open up. Don't be stupid about it.
I think some of our performance car customers just like, you know, the fact that there's all that power underneath their foot and the noise our cars make is just incredible. So I'm a big noise guy. If the guys build a car for me, it better sound like a muscle car. So,
VRM Chris wants to know, will Lingenfelter do tuning on smaller vehicles, given that vehicles are going smaller as well as engines?
One of our claims to fame was our ability to tune Ecotec engines and such. We're looking at that. We're looking at also some of our younger customers and some things that they might like. We've got a couple things back on our internal dyno I can't talk about, but they're not V8s, and so there's some opportunity there. I think there's a lot of fun in that end. The problem I have is you can't make them sound like a V8.
That's a problem. Yeah, you know, exhaust note counts. It really does.
It really does. Yeah.
Okay. What are your three? This is from Goggles Pisano. What are your three favorite GM cars to tune?
Well, obviously the Camaro. As I said earlier, the Camaro is a tuner's dream, and we're doing some wonderful things with it. Obviously, we can get more out of the LS3 that's in it. The car we're going to take down to the Camaro Forum in Chandler in a few weeks is going to be a 427. It'll be a twin-turbo car. Superchargers are great either through Magnuson or through Eldebrock. We've worked a lot with Vic Eldebrock and the new E4 superchargers for those cars. And Corvettes, we've got a steady line of customers for Corvettes. They bring us their C5, and then they bring us their C6. And I'm sure once the new Corvette is done, we'll get a chance to focus on whatever they do with that. So,
cool. I see we've got some phone calls coming in. Ben, let's bring in one of them.
Hey, guys. Hey, I had a question for the Automine board there. With all the technology they have today, is there really a need for premium fuel like you guys get? Sonata has the 2.0 turbo that runs off of 87 octane, and racing teams using E85. I was just wondering if it was even a need for 91 octane or premium fuel. Thanks, guys. Do a good job.
I think it's up to the manufacturer. I mean, if they rate it that it needs it, you should run it. Now, manufacturers some of them will admit that if you run lower octane, they won't deliver the power. But I think you go with what the manufacturer suggests.
I would say, though, that, you know, for regular everyday folks,
yeah,
you probably shouldn't design an engine that needs premium. For performance cars, absolutely. High octane makes a huge difference. And if you have an aux sensor that can take advantage of that octane, all the better still.
But, you know, there are a lot of Volkswagens that have to run premium.
And, mm-hmm.
You know.
There are.
BMWs and...
But you're right, John. I mean, the way that the electronics all works together now with NOx sensing, and if you put 110 octane race gas in an engine, and it's never going to hear NOx, it just keeps advancing the spark and makes more power, especially when it's boosted.
In fact, we just got a release, I think, yesterday from Ford, which has figured out a new way of calculating the alcohol or ethanol content in gasoline. They do it on molecules.
On a molecular level rather than the volume.
Exactly right. Yeah. Exactly right. And, you know, again, with EcoBoost and an aux sensor, as you're talking about there, Jim, you know, that's one of the things that's overlooked about ethanol is it's high octane. It's 110 octane. And if you can take advantage of that, you can. In fact, Ricardo built an engine running on E85 that got better fuel economy than running on pure gasoline by taking advantage of the higher octane in it. So there's fun things that you can play around with on that regard. Ben, let's bring in another one of those phone calls.
Hi, Jim Campbell calling from Calgary, Canada. With regards to your whether or not cars are collector cars are going to be worth anything, there was a point in time, I think, the Model T was worth a huge amount of dollars, but now they've greatly reduced in price. With the age group of the people that had some sort of nostalgic connection to them, as long as the nostalgic connection is going to leave, I think the younger generation coming up behind me anyway is not going to be at all interested in the collector cars or the muscle cars, just like anybody won't be interested in the Commodore 64 computer. Have a great day, guys.
Great. What do you think about that?
He's making a really good point. You know, in the auctions I go to, it's amazing how we're watching some of the older cars really, you know, losing their value. And it'll happen to muscle cars, too, and on forward. We've even seen some of our Corvette buyers. I mean, the younger crowd these days aren't interested in buying Corvettes. That's just not, you know, a cool thing for them. I've got a Nissan GTR that I take out, and it gets as much attention as a Ferrari with the young crowd because, you know, that was the car that everybody had on PlayStation, that the Skyline that beat out everything else. So
too bad it looks like shit.
Well,
another story.
That is another story.
But it is attractive to that age group. So I agree completely. That's exactly what's
there. There is, unfortunately, this a body of opinion in sociological and cultural anthropological circles that says the kids now just don't care about cars the way their elders did, and certainly the way we did, that they would rather be in a quiet room with one of those laptops, you know, communicating or playing some kind of a game than being out there, you know, going someplace.
Yeah, well, we've talked about that. This is a huge worry with the manufacturers right now. This started in Tokyo about 6 years ago.
All the tuner kids just stopped, right?
Yeah, and, well, the smartphone was, you know, they were more interested in that. And it's, you know, it's a huge worry for the manufacturers. They are constantly searching for ways to engage young kids.
Like so. Fiesta Nation and some of the stuff that...
Yeah, Fiesta Movement, yeah, and it worked. But, you know, I'm thinking we need to just go down to the grade schools.
Yeah. Well, I still say...
Give them all go-karts.
Yeah.
Once you drive a go-kart and you're in grade school, you're done.
You'll never go back. That's right.
That's exactly right. Yeah, for sure.
Well, I think part of the thing, too, is in a lot of places like Tokyo, owning a car is a hassle.
Yeah.
You know, parking it is... You can't even buy a car in Tokyo unless you
have to prove you have a place to park it before they'll sell it to you.
Exactly right. And so you want to go out with your friends. Okay, now you got to get your car. Now you got to go pick them all up. And now you go to a club or a bar or somebody's place. And now what do you do with the car? Now it's
a big somebody hassle to drive it around.
No, I still say autonomous cars is going to solve all that, because now your car, if you're not driving, the car drives itself. It is the party mobile. And if you go someplace, you tell the car to go park itself, and it's wired into the system, and it'll go there.
Gone off the grid, John.
Yeah, yeah. But there's got to be some cars that, irrespective of generational change, just hold their value. There's got to be cars that transcend that.
There really are. I mean, you know, in the word is, and when you go to auctions, they always say they're real good cars. Cars that, you know, are real cars that aren't fake cars. Cars that have got reputation. Chrysler 300s, the late 50s, those cars still do very well at auction. You know, the early Corvettes still do really good. Early muscle cars, yeah, you know, those still do pretty well, too, as long as they're real cars. So right now...
What do you mean, real cars?
Well, yeah, obviously...
Matching
when
numbers.
When anything goes up in price, there's always a group of people that will go out to try and fake cars. So they'll buy a Corvette, and they'll try and find ways to get the numbers faked on it and everything else to make it look like it's an original numbers-matching car, and change the speedometer reading and do whatever you have to do. And to somebody who really knows what they're doing, you can see through that and not let that happen. So a real car is a numbers-matching, you know, original, sometimes a survivor car. Cars that, you know, were important back then are important today because of their genuine factory original parts and things like that. So yeah, those are real cars. And those still do really well at auction. They really do.
Yeah. So. Is there anybody in the United States who doesn't want a 57 Chevy convertible?
I'm sure there's a few. But, you know... To, you know, what we were saying before, yeah, I think a lot of people, if they just look at a car, it has very expressive styling. I think that's the key right there, that people just go, wow, that looks so cool, and man, wouldn't I look cool in it.
One of the favorite cars in my collection is a 66 Olds Toronado.
Yeah, and beautiful.
Even people who are younger, they look at that thing, and you can see it. It's got so many incredible style.
It still looks futuristic to me.
Stunning car.
Beautiful car.
Yeah.
Really.
And the powertrain at that time.
Engineered by Bob Stemple.
Bob Stemple.
Right.
That's right. Front wheel drive. Let's see. We got another call here. Ben, let's bring it in.
Hi, John. This is Warren Webb from Paris, California. I'm calling in regards to Peter's remarks today about Bob King and the UAW, and I couldn't agree with him more.
Oh,
I think Mr. King should take a history lesson and look and see how his local number 5 did to Studebaker in 1961 when they finally had to settle that strike. The workers there were getting paid more there than they were in Detroit. And then less than 2 years later, they had no job. And if Mr. King wants to continue on his present course, then that eventually is going to happen. History is going to repeat itself. At least that's my opinion. Thanks for the opportunity to call, and you guys have a good day. Thank you.
Good point. Thank
you. Thanks for the call.
Well, John, you mentioned something to me in an email today. You mentioned three plants.
Well, yeah, I think this is a really good point that Bob King and the UAW want to organize the transplants, you know, the foreign car companies in the United States. Well, they had three of those plants. They had NUMMI, Diamond Star, which was Mitsubishi, and the Flat Rock plant here in Michigan, which was Mazda. NUMMI's closed. You know, Diamond Star, the Mitsubishi plant, it's on life support right now. And the Flat Rock plant, Mazda's walking away from that. Ford's got it. I don't know if that place will stay open or not. So, again, if the union wants
only source for Mustangs.
It could, but Ford's even talked about maybe they'd do something different because there's not enough volume with Mustang right now to keep that plant going and make it viable. And if Mazda pulls out, which maybe the earthquake in Japan will change things right now, but Mazda was talking about pulling out of that plant. You know, then the union's got some splaining to do because the three transplants it had, you know, are either dead or dying. So
they want to go down south and go into the new Kia plant and the new Hyundai plant.
They're going to go nowhere doing that.
Well, that's what they'd like. That's what they're look, what I find interesting is in January, Bob King said, before the month is out, we're going to announce who our target is. It's March. We're getting towards the end of March, and we haven't heard. And now he's saying, well, we're talking more about it. And well, that tells me that
we know
they've run into problems.
Yeah, but we know who their target is for the fall. It's going to be Ford.
Oh, yeah, for the big three.
But you're talking about targeting the southern plants.
Well, the transplants.
Yeah.
My guess is, you know, if I were them, I'd go after Volkswagen. With this
brand new plant that hasn't built a car yet in Chattanooga.
Well, but because, remember, in Germany, all companies organized as AG, by law, have
a union member on the board.
Their supervisory board has to be labor. So I think that you might find a much more sympathetic voice at Volkswagen than at, say, Hyundai, Kia, Volkswagen, or
Honda.
Because
they're used to it.
Because of that, right.
But I think the people who are lining up to work in that plant, they don't want to hear that.
I agree with
you. You know, this is a boost to their local economy and gives them a hold on a different future. And, you know, they're going to freely sign up to work there.
Yeah.
They're not going to need
it. And then when the vote comes, they'll just say, no thanks.
No thanks. I did a lot to get here, and I'm not giving someone a cut.
But, you know, well, I don't want to belabor this whole labor thing. Let's move on to another. Ben, let's bring in another call.
My name's Dave Britton. I was wondering, though, do you think that there is such a thing as overpay? You were talking about Alan and his amount of money. Don't you think there's such a thing as getting overpaid? I mean, as you said, a lot of them ran companies into the ground and still got major bonuses for it. And maybe Alan does deserve it, but Wagner and all those that left from the time that Smith was in charge of GM all the way through WAC, I don't think there was any of them that deserved the bonuses they got. So just a thought.
That may be true.
I'm a UAW worker, and we did work hard on the line. Nothing built itself in an assembly plant. But have a good day. Enjoy your show.
Thanks.
Yeah, thanks. That may be true, but Alan deserves the money. I'll go on record.
Well, the thing he raises a good point.
Yeah, they got overpaid for
Executives who get paid big bucks, but don't deliver the results, yeah, that's overpaid. That should never happen. And
but that's in any industry.
That's in any industry, not just the automotive.
Yeah, that's banking.
And I agree with this guy. The guys who were working on the line, they worked their asses off.
Yeah.
I totally agree that they should get paid more money. But what I'd like to see happen, and I think this is what's going to happen, is you do it through profit sharing. And when there's profits, man, write checks for everybody. And when there's no profits, tighten up your belt and slog through until times get good again. Yeah. But don't lock in these higher costs. And if we do that, guess what? We're going to build a whole lot more cars in this country than just importing them. Ben, we got another one. Let's bring it in.
This is Jim from Sioux Falls. I remember watching an episode of Motor Week a few years ago where there were several manufacturers competing against one another, and one of the cars was a Ligenfelter Corvette, and that was your cousin John that was on that episode. And these cars went through several events, and one by one, they dropped out of the competition. The German cars broke down, and all these other cars had mechanical problems. And in the end, it was the Ligenfelter Corvette that won that competition. It was really impressive. I believe that car had a twin turbo on it. So
yes,
that's
how
I found out about your cousin and your cars, and it was really fun to watch. Thanks. Bye.
You know, we're all really proud of John. I mean, the incredible cars he built, the reliability. And, you know, the fact of the matter is after you got done racing it, you could typically drive it to the grocery store. You know, he actually raced a Blue Angel in one of those twin-turbo cars.
No kidding.
Motor Trend did a program with that. As I said, we're doing our best to try and continue to live out John's legacy. He built an incredible brand, and we're having a lot of fun.
John was, I watched him drag race for years on end in all kinds of bodied cars, and then he decided he would build a dragster, and it used an Oldsmobile 500 cubic inch DRCE engine. And I remember an incident at the U.S. Nationals. Nobody has ever done this before or since. It broke. He called up a helicopter outfit at the Indianapolis airport and said, I need to go to Decatur, Indiana right now. Come and get me. And, you know, the drag strip is this big open place. The helicopter landed. He jumped in it. He flew to his shop. He got the parts he needed. He came back. He put the parts on the engine and made the next round. That's the kind of
I love those stories.
Driven man that he was, I believe, a wrestler at Penn State.
Yep.
He had an upper body that was just, his arms were this big around. And he had a flattened nose. I'm sure that happened somewhere in the course of wrestling. But he was a terrific. I rode with him in the rig once from Decatur, Indiana, to Gainesville, Florida, for the NHRA Gator Nationals, because I was going to do a story on him in Hot Rod Magazine. And I just wanted to find out what made him tick. Competition made him tick.
Yeah.
He was very driven.
That's
for sure.
Very cool. We got a few more questions here. Mr. Lingenfelter, are the 400 horsepower cars luxury car buyers? I didn't read that right. Are the 400 horsepower cars that luxury car buyers are driving even a little bit silly?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, the fact of the matter is, you know, the freedom to be able to drive and enjoy what you want, I think, is a pretty important thing. And
yeah, that's kind of why we live here.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you know, what's silly? I mean, if you want it, you want it. And if you're going to enjoy it and that's where you get your kicks, then I think more power to you.
And to your point, Peter, that's what you can do in this country.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, do I think these you see these kids driving around with these kind of imitation monster trucks where they need ladders to go. Yeah, is it stupid? Yeah, but hey.
God bless America.
Yeah, you know, if you want to learn the hard way, that's really not so cool.
Well, I think it's a...
when you rip the transmission out of it, it's all right.
It's a testament to the whole industry that we got through all those terrible times in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s. And the ZR1 makes 640 horsepower, passes emissions, and gets 30 miles to the gallon on the highway.
That's extraordinary, right?
It really is.
Or whatever it is, 27, 28.
Yeah.
Whatever it is, it's good.
Well, that's the EPA label. But you can get 30 out of it.
It's, you know, And that's one among many. I mean, all these Hemi-powered cars that are running around with the big Hemi and getting very decent mileage because somebody figured out, well, four speeds were good, five is better, six is still better. Let's have eight or nine.
Nine's on the way, that's right. Comment from Jim. Have or would the Lingenfelter team ever go with Chevy to the IndyCar engine program?
You know, that's probably a stretch. I think that Chevrolet and General Motors is real intent on building a lot of the things themselves these days. They really want the stuff to be their own product all the way through. So, you know, we're drag racers and road racers, and that's where we have our fun. That's where our customer group is, and I expect that's what we'll always do.
You're going to say something, Jim?
Well, they do have, General Motors does have a very, very nice engine building, professional racing engine building facility, not that far from here,
about 15 minutes from here, right?
And as he says, you know,
that's where they build all their top engines,
and that's where they're going to apparently build all the Indy engines when that gets all sorted out. I guess next year we go to the new car and the new engine formula.
Yeah, it's going to be
pretty 2012. Exciting. I think that's right. So Pedro Craig from Facebook is written in to say, I wonder if there is a turbo V6 in the future for the new GM Compact. Can you say Cyclone?
Cyclone, Typhoon.
Those were pretty cool vehicles.
Grand National, GNX. Those were great cars right out of the box.
Yeah.
And they know how to do it better now than they did then. That was, what, 15 years
and
ago?
And also, I mean, the electronics are better. Everything's better, you know.
Well, look, we ought to wrap it up here, but it's...
Oh, do we have to? We were just getting
well,
rolling.
Well, we don't have to, but it's, I got to cut my crew here so they can go home at some point, too. But, Ken, it's been great having you on the show here. Just great conversation.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun for me, too. Appreciate
cool.
being here.
Excellent. And Jim McCraw, great having you here.
Thank
really
you.
Enjoyed
really
having
fun.
You on here. And I'm not going to say anything to Peter because he'll be back here next week anyway.
Yeah, I showed up again.
But as always, Peter, great having you here as well. I'd like to take a moment to promo some of the upcoming guests that we've got on the show, including next week, Joel Piskowski, who is the head of all exterior design for Ford of the Americas. Coming up a couple of weeks after that, we have Bob Casey, the transportation curator at the Henry Ford Museum, the guy's wealth of information. Later on, we're going to have Barb Samardich from Ford, who we think does all Ford powertrain, but I believe there's even more to that. We're going to have to look that up. And then in early May, we're going to have Larry Burns, who used to run all R&D for General Motors. He's now a professor at the University of Michigan, but that guy definitely knows technology, and that'll be a great show, too. And thanks, folks, for having tuned in. It's been great having you along with us.
Visit our website, outoflinedetroit.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily automotive news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline Detroit. That's all there and much more at AutolineDetroit.tv.
Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence, and by Chevrolet, the all-new Chevrolet Cruze. Get used to more.